This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today I'll be talking to Jerry Grillo about his new book, Big Cat, The Life of Baseball Hall of Famer Johnny Mize. Jerry's work has appeared in George Trend, Atlanta Magazine, Paste Magazine, and Newsday, and his previous book is called The Music and Mythocracy of Colonel Bruce Hampton. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Paul. I'm really glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So you wrote this wonderful book about Johnny Mize, and you know, you kind of start off by a little bit talking about how this book came about, and you initially had the idea over 20 years ago, and life got in the way, as it often does, and you came back to it. Had you always planned on writing this book? Did you always know you'd come back to it?
You know, it was funny that you asked that, Paul. I've been asked that, and I've been on the fence about it, actually, because, you know, during those 20 something years, we were so busy with family obligations and the challenges, you know, that come with our lives. And I thought about it. It was in the back of my head, but life had really taken such a drastic turn. I was way more interested in music. I thought I'd be writing music books and wrote one. But at some point, my daughter kept reminding me. She says, "Dad, you're always talking about baseball. When are you going to write a baseball book, for God's sakes?" And, you know, and I thought, well, I had started this book, and it was sort of, you know, the research part of it anyway, before life, as you said, sort of took a left turn. And then I thought I'd come back to it for two big reasons: my daughter's nagging, and the fact that I had interviewed a few people already. And I felt like, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I kind of owed it to these people whose time I had taken. People like Whitey Ford, you know, Bobby Brown, the former president of the American League. Those are the more notable ones. But then there's Judy Mize, Johnny Mize's daughter, who had passed away. And so there were people who had already passed away who I had interviewed. And I thought, you know, these people gave me their time, their interest. I was sincerely interested at the time and had to put the book down. So I wanted to finish that. And that's sort of what drove me, I guess, the year and a half it took me to finally, you know, pick up the book and write it.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of a theme throughout this book is that Johnny Mize, to some extent, has been overlooked, certainly, and possibly even forgotten by some. You know, I mean, you documented how long it took him to get in the Hall of Fame, for example, and he doesn't receive the recognition, or isn't talked about as much as some of his peers. You know, a Hank Greenberg or a Ralph Kiner, for example. What appealed to you about Mize's story? Why did you want to bring his story to light?
Well, you kind of hit it on the head there, Paul. I think the fact that he was sort of overlooked, I was interested because, again, I remember stories of this guy when I was a kid that my father and uncles would talk about. And he was mentioned in the same breath as Yogi Berra, DiMaggio, Mantle, some of the Yankees who were part of that 5-year run that they had from 49 to 53. And then, you know, I got interested in that, and I found out that he was one of only 12 players, which actually it's not a small number, but 12 players were on all five of those teams. And that was kind of interesting to me. And I looked at who the other the other 11 were. And, you know, he kind of stands out. He was the only one, I think, in that group who was a certified Hall of Fame slugger. You know, the other thing that interested me, I think, was just, frankly, moving here to this part of the country and finding out he was from here. As the editor of the local newspaper, you know, it was great local news to talk about the legend who was had born and died in Northeast Georgia. But then to actually meet his daughter, who introduced herself to me one day, that just sort of got it, made it a little more personal, I guess. And so the more I dug into his career, the more it was like peeling an onion. I found out these fascinating stories that nobody really knew about, and I thought it was worth a book.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you start off talking about kind of his demise family history, and very quickly you drop this fascinating anecdote that Johnny Mize is related to both Ty Cobb and Babe Ruth. And I was like, what? How could that be? And that was kind of the beginning of Johnny Mize. Almost, it was kind of like the Forrest Gump of baseball. Talk a little bit about those family relations with Cobb and Gump. Cobb and Ruth.
No, I think Gump is okay. It's funny that you caught that, because I've sort of thought of him also as sort of the Forrest Gump or Zelig of you know, of baseball, you know, the guy who sort of turns up in all of these different places and he's related to Ty Cobb. He's a blood relative of Ty Cobb on his dad's side of the family. He's like a second or third cousin. They shared like a great or great great grandfather. And then he's related to Babe Ruth also on his father's side through his cousin Claire, who, of course, was Babe Ruth's second and long-lasting wife, Claire Merritt Hodgson Ruth, who, Johnny knew her. She was actually from here in Northeast Georgia as well, but lived for a time in Athens, which is a university town. But she and Johnny knew each other, and when he got older, he would sort of half-jokingly refer to them as cousins Claire and George. But yeah, he was this is interesting that he was related to these two original Hall of Famers, and then that it took him so long to get into the Hall of Fame. He even had Claire Ruth sort of pitching for him, you know, get Johnny in the Hall of Fame. And the reason that I think that was interesting to me is because it was very important to Johnny Mize. I had someone else ask me, why did you focus on this Hall of Fame lapse, it took so long to get him into the Hall of Fame. Why was that interesting? Well, it was interesting to me because Mize, who was sort of a taciturn person, when he did talk to the press later in life, that's what he talked about. He talked about his legacy. He was very proud of it, and he wondered why he wasn't in the Hall of Fame. And so much in the record was him talking about this. I thought, I really need to give that some attention, and especially with that relationship to two of the original Hall of Famers. It just seemed like a theme to sort of follow.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Johnny grew up in Northeast Georgia. What was his childhood like?
It was interesting. He came from a kind of a broken home, which, you know, in a small town could be a challenge, I guess. But he also had a tight-knit community around him in Demarest, Georgia, raised by his grandmother and his aunt. His parents split up when he was probably 6 or 7. His father had a difficult life. He had a disability. He was hearing impaired, but he also struggled with alcohol, I found out through talking with some of Johnny's family. And so his mom went to Atlanta, which is about 80, 90 miles away from Demarest, and lived there to take on a job and send money back home. So it was sort of an unusual broken home situation. But I think he always felt taken care of and felt loved by, again, his grandmother was a strong personality, and his aunt. And again, a small community where everybody had gardens and grew food and took care of each other, if you will. That almost that Mayberry kind of atmosphere. And yet it was a college town. So it was in rural Northeast Georgia with a small college, not much else, you know. And I think in some ways there was a Norman Rockwell feel to it for him, you know, growing up in this little picket fence mountain community. But again, in other ways, it was a challenge because he didn't have like a father in his life to teach him how to play baseball. He was a self-taught prodigy. And that's how Johnny and his brother, I think, played a lot together, played a lot of tennis together. Easy to play tennis with two guys. And he worked out his batting swing by actually hitting a tennis ball with a bat against the side of a building to improve his tennis game. And in doing so, he improved his batting eye and became this hitting prodigy.
Yeah, he certainly was a prodigy. I mean, you know, you talk in the book about how he was playing college baseball in high school.
Yes, he was a college baseball player in high school. The town was so small that the local high school didn't have a baseball team. So the college, being a small private school, this would have been in the 20s, they had no problem letting the better high school players join the team if they could. And Johnny was one of the few. I don't think he was the only high school athlete to ever play at Piedmont, but probably the only one to play 3 or 4 years because he kept playing even after he became a pro, signed as a 17-year-old to play minor league baseball. He would come back and play college ball for Piedmont, which is interesting. You know, they were able to somehow circumvent the eligibility rules in those days. Which I always found interesting. He always chuckled about that too. He said it's one of the records he has. It'll never be broken. He played college ball as a high school kid for 3 or 4 years.
As you mentioned, he got signed at age 17 by the Cardinals organization. I mean, 17 years old from small town, you know, rural Georgia. How did he adapt to playing professional ball?
It's interesting. That first few weeks in the minors were, I think, a little rough for him. He'd only batted about 194, but it was a great taste of what the future would be like for him when he was signed. I think it's one of those classic Americana kind of tales. I mean, how does a 17-year-old kid from the woods of North Georgia get discovered by Branch Rickey? And it was he was playing for a lot of local company teams, like a lot of people did in those days who are good enough. He was playing for a lumber company team. The lumber company was based in Rochester, New York, where the Cardinals had one of their top farm clubs. The owner of the lumber company was friends with the president of the Rochester club, Warren Giles, who heard about this behemoth and let Branch Rickey know, who was the general manager of the Cardinals. And Branch sent Frank, his brother, down to watch Johnny and sign him up for a robust $150 a month. And Johnny, you know, at that point didn't care about the money. He was just excited to get out of town and play ball. And as I said, it was a rough couple of weeks for him, but he got a taste and he continued to keep going back for every year for about 20 years and teams kept signing him. And I think when he was 18 and he played his first full year of pro ball when he was 18, he was a superstar right away. He was a 300 hitter, hitting for power. There was no doubt that he was a gamer. The only problem was he was in the Cardinals system, which was called the chain gang, because it was vast. I mean, they had dozens of teams across the country. So most players, even great prospects, moved sideways for a long time before they moved up in the organization. So he figured out how to play the game very, very well, but it took him a while to get to the major leagues.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that, you know, the chain gang. One of the things I really enjoyed about this book is, you know, it's not just the Johnny Mize story. It's Johnny Mize and his times and what you know, there are certain things that were going on in baseball that you really delve into, which I thought added great texture to the book. You know, one of them being the minor league system at the time that he got caught up in, and you know even just things talking about how players went barnstorming, and I you know found just the whole discussion about Mize negotiating his contracts and how that worked in the 1930s and the 1940s and things like that. So I think that really added a great deal to the book. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the minor league thing, because, you know, obviously everyone hears Branch Rickey and right away you think Jackie Robinson, and that was, you know, kind of Rickey's great contribution to the game, which obviously it was, but arguably his contribution to, you know, the impact of minor league baseball and the role he played in that was even more significant.
Exactly. I think so. Rickey is one of those figures who has been called, you know, maybe the only genius in white baseball history. I mean, there were certainly some in the Negro Leagues too. You think of Rube Foster, the man who invented the Negro Leagues, but Branch invented the minor leagues. And he realized that the Cardinals were not going to be able to compete with some of the richer clubs. And so they could develop their own talent a lot cheaper. So he started by creating these business arrangements and collaborations with minor league clubs. And then they began buying the clubs, actually owning the clubs and owning the talent. The Cardinals and Rickey, in particular, were way ahead of everybody else in this area. And it actually paid off fairly quickly. They won pennants in the late 20s, early 30s. Seemed like every other year the Cardinals were in the World Series. And these were oftentimes players that Rickey had developed in the minor leagues. Now, other clubs, of course, caught on eventually in the 30s. You had the Yankees and some of the others finally sort of following Rickey's example. But in the early 30s, they were far and away ahead of everyone else. And so Johnny Mize discovers quite early that getting signed by a major league club doesn't mean, at least with the Cardinals in those days, that you're going to play major league ball right away. There was some of it was about protecting the talent. You know, Rickey was tight with a buck. And I think even Jackie Robinson would have said that once he got into the game. But again, Rickey did so much good for the game. The fact that players like Mize and others did not get along with him over money, you know, doesn't take away from his reputation as a genius, but it does add a little bit of texture to who Rickey was as a businessman. He was one of those guys who he had promised his mother he would never go to the stadium on a Sunday, the church day, the day of God. But Branch didn't have any trouble accepting the dividends that came in from Sunday baseball. You know, he was a smart man. And he invented the minor leagues. And unfortunately for Johnny, that's who he signed up with. He was an old man, sort of complained that, man, if I had just held out, I might have gotten signed by the Cleveland Indians, you know, and I would have gotten straight to the major leagues, right? Because some clubs, if they signed a player, they went right to the major leagues. They might have played a year of farm league ball under contract, but Johnny was in the minors for 6 years, and that wasn't unusual for the Cardinals. The Cardinals had a lot of 26, 27-year-old rookies, let's put it that way, guys who had spent their early 20s in the minor leagues.
Right. And while Johnny was in the minor leagues, you know, well, first of all, as we said, he was kind of the Forrest Gump of baseball, and we'll get into some of this, but some of the guys that he played with, some of the names, you know, DiMaggio, Mantle, Barham, usual, we could go on, and of course played against the greats of his day, like Ted Williams and Jackie Robinson and on and on. But one winter, he played ball in Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. And it was then that he actually shared a field with a guy that he believes is the greatest player he'd ever seen. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Definitely. That's my favorite chapter in the book, because for me, it was really like discovering treasure. Johnny Mize spent the winter of 33 and 34 when he was still a minor leaguer, 20 years old and turning 21 in Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, as you said, barnstorming first with a team called the Richmond Colts. And this was just a barnstorming club that a minor league manager had assembled with a few players from Richmond, players from Rochester like Johnny Mize, even a few major leaguers. And they all go down to Puerto Rico to make some extra money and enjoy the beaches and the weather. And while he's there, Mize, one of the larger players, is scouted by a man named Martin Diego. And Martin Diego, at that time, already had established a reputation as maybe the best baseball player in the world, at least among Negro Leaguers who had a chance to see him play. Diego was a Black Cuban ball player who could play every position and hit with power. He had an arm like nobody's business, the best pitcher and the best hitter in Latin America at the time. So he's running a team out of based in Venezuela that's owned by a dictator's son. And Diego is assembling this murderer's row to play in what was called the Trujillo tournament in the Dominican Republic, named after the dictator, Rafael Trujillo, bloodthirsty, sort of evil guy. And the Dominican was sort of a combustible place at the time. I mean, there were fans and soldados walking around with guns and it was a lot of hell raising. And here's 20, 21-year-old Johnny Mize, you know, from Demarest, Georgia, one of the few English-speaking people on the ball club that Diego had assembled. And they're lauding him as the great blonde American in the Dominican press for his beastly home runs, you know, that would leave the stadium. And you know, I'm just in love with this because I'm imagining, what is this? And he's a quiet guy. He's just a big, quiet guy who would prefer to listen than to talk. And I'm wondering what he's taking in during this 3-4 month stay in the islands, when he's seeing Martin Diego day after day. He sees Josh Gibson. He sees some of the greatest players that most American fans, I should say most white American fans, had never heard of. And here's Mize getting a sampling of this and playing among these guys. And it just sort of blew my mind that there wasn't much out there. I did find a little bit on the internet, on some sort of community boards from his sort of Latino sort of websites, right? I really did some digging here. And then I found out that a fellow Sabre member, Sabre is the Society for American Baseball Research, had done a little bit of work on a few other players from the Dominican. And in doing so, had told some Mize stories. That led me to some Dominican newspapers that I was able to find. I was able to find a database of a Dominican newspaper, and that was discovering treasure. That's where I found what I wanted to find about Mize's adventure, because for many years this was just, it was unknown. Even his children didn't know about this. He didn't talk about it unless he was asked, and that's why he made his statement as a very old man when asked by a writer who the greatest player he ever saw was, and he said, the greatest player I ever saw was a Black man named Martin Diego. Mize was close to the end at that point, so nobody had really asked him about that, and he was not much of a storyteller. Once you got him going, he could tell a story, but he was not going to offer it. And that's why he probably took a lot of interesting stories like this to his grave. And I can only imagine, because as you said, he was sort of the Forrest Gump, the Zelig of baseball. He saw and did a lot of things. And he only talked about it, I think, when asked.
Interesting. So, you know, you mentioned he was in the minor leagues for 6 years. How did he finally get his shot in the big leagues, and how did that work out for him?
It's funny. It happened in fits and starts. He was first, the Cardinals first sold him for the princely sum of $55,000 when he was, he must have been in his fifth year in the minors at that time. He had injured himself. He had a very rare injury to his pelvis. But he had seemed to have recovered, and they sold him to the Reds, the Cincinnati Reds, then run by Larry McPhail. And there was a condition. The condition was that if Mize was still hurt, the Reds could send him back to the Cardinals, system, and get their money back. But for one spring, 1935, he was a Cincinnati Red, and he tore it up. He hit the ball like he invented the game, batted over 400 during spring training, hit some of the longest home runs anybody had ever seen at the Reds training facility, had a chance to play against his cousin, Babe Ruth, who was in his last year at playing with the Boston Braves. So the only time that Johnny ever met the Babe in actual competition was during that spring training of 1935. Well, the day before opening day, the Larry McPhail and the Reds decide they just don't want to take a chance. He had started hurting again. He was still hitting the ball like there was no tomorrow, but he was in obvious pain and he was fielding his position, but he was hurting. They sent him back. And so he spent another year in the minors, got an operation from the Cardinals team physician. And in 1936, after that other year in the minors, a pain-filled year, he made his debut in the major leagues at 23, and he was an instant success. That wasn't a surprise to Branch Rickey or his brother Frank, but Johnny came in. He hit 329, he might have led the team in runs batted in, but he was definitely among the leaders in the league, and and that was the beginning of his major league career. And people wondered, where has this guy been?
Yeah, and clearly, you know, he emerged as one of the elite hitters in the game. How good was Johnny Mize in those early years with the Cardinals?
Well, he was so good that when he made that, by the time he made it to the, and I'm being cute when I say, where has he been all this time? Baseball people at that time knew who was who. They knew the Cardinals had a bunch of guys and that were protected in their farm system. But there were offers even before he made it to the major leagues. For example, when he was purchased by the Reds, the story was Casey Stengel would have given up his entire infield or half of his team on the Brooklyn Dodgers to get Mize. Bill Terry, who was the manager of the New York Giants at the time, was ready to do hand flips to get Mize on his team. And this is before he even cracked the Cardinals lineup. So he was a known quantity, and he lived up to the billing. This is how good he was. With the Cardinals, those first 5 or 6 years, he was always among the league leaders in slugging percentage, batting average, home runs. I mean, top three in runs batted in. I mean, virtually every offensive category. That's what was interesting about him. He did it all. I mean, he hit for average. He hit, which wasn't so unusual in that age, right? We talk about the 30s, and you think of Lou Gehrig and Hank Greenberg and Jimmy Fox and guys who hit 350 and so on. Well, Mize was hanging with that group, and he was seen as their peer. And so he may have been the best left-handed hitter in the National League for those years as a young stud, right? Hitting for power, hitting for average to all fields. That was the other thing. He could hit with equal power to left field as he could to right field, as a young man especially. And so he was in demand. And because he would speak for himself, he would speak his mind when it came to contract time. And he didn't have a problem telling Branch Rickey, you know, I'm worth more than that. Every year, it seemed he was trade bait. There was talk about, well, he's not as good as he thinks he is, you know, from the Cardinals brass, which was a typical tactic in those days in the days before a union, when the reserve clause held sway. So Mize would challenge Rickey. Usually he'd sign for less than what he wanted, but a little more than what Branch was offering. And as a result, he was also dangled as trade bait. And it seemed every year the Cubs or the Giants or somebody was offering their best player for Mize. And this went on for years until it finally actually happened with the Giants.
Right. And he played one season with the Giants, and I believe one season with the Giants. And then, like many of the great stars of his day, went off to the military. What was his military service like, and how did he feel about being in the military?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. He was always very, I mean, he certainly wasn't in Bob Feller's league when it came to patriotic fervor, but he was, you know, willing to do his part. But he also had there were some extenuating circumstances, right? Mize was the chief source of income for his grandmother and his aunt still, and actually was still sending money home to his mom, who was working, right? So for a while there, Johnny was deferred from the draft for a short time, but he let it be known that he was willing to serve when and if the time came. And when they removed some of the restrictions for men like Mize, and he was going to be drafted, he decided to join the Navy. He just, you know, he volunteered. And I think it was probably with the understanding that he would be volunteering with his bat as opposed to a rifle. Like many players in those days, he played baseball and he served more in a sort of entertainment capacity, entertaining the troops, you know, a morale sort of booster, if you will. And, you know, had some duties as like a physical training instructor and this kind of thing. But mostly Mize was a baseball player during his 3 years in the military. He played on what were probably the best teams in America, because so many players had gone into the military. The major leagues, as we know, was a diluted product. And so a lot of the stars were playing on these service teams. And Mize was on one in the Great Lakes Naval Training Center, that was managed by Mickey Cochran, who was, the legend, a former all-star, future Hall of Fame catcher. And he managed a team of stars like Mize, a number of other players who were either minor leaguers or were major leaguers. And they played about 50 or 60 games, often against major league clubs. And they actually split with the major league teams. This Navy team went like 12-12 against major league clubs that would come into the Naval Training Station. And this was all, again, part of morale boosting for troops. They would get, you know, thousands of sailors would show up before they would be shipped out, of course, to war, to come watch Mize and his colleagues play. And then, of course, it is the military, so you don't stay in one place very long. He was shipped to Hawaii. And in Hawaii, it was the same thing, an even better ball club. The Navy had a team that was included Dom DiMaggio, and Joe DiMaggio was playing for the Army team. And you had just every all-star you can imagine, Phil Rizzuto, Pee Wee Reese, these guys were all playing with Mize on this Navy team that beat everybody. And so again, he enjoyed time there and serving as like a physical training instructor, you know, in Hawaii. And then the closest Johnny actually got to a dangerous warlike situation was his last year. He was stationed on Tinian, and Tinian is the island where the bombers took off to drop the atomic bombs on Japan. And so Johnny was there again, mainly, and this was not as showy as Hawaii and the Great Lakes. This was out of the way. You know, this was a little bit closer to Japan and to the front, a little more serious, but there was definitely some fun. He helped build ball fields. He did physical training like volleyball and stuff like this, again, to help the troops. But this was actually where he got back into shape for the major leagues, because he had gotten quite fat during his time in the Navy. And he always had a little bit of a problem with his weight. And so he worked off probably 20 or 30 pounds and came back to the major leagues in 1946 to the New York Giants in the best physical shape he'd been in probably since he was a rookie, you know, maybe 205 pounds trim and ready to start hitting home runs again.
I don't remember how, I mean, I think it, early to mid 30s, I think at this point was had been out of pro ball for a few years. Was there concern that he was washed up, that he was done when he came back?
I think as with a lot of the players coming back, there was concern that they had that he either lost a step or the years had caught up with them. Johnny, when the war ended, was 33. So he was at that point, and there was some question, but there was also a great deal of anticipation and positivity. I mean, they were looking forward to getting him back. Mellott, the manager, thought that he'd be able to help the team because in spring training, he looked great. And a lot of the returning players did look great. They thought it might take a while to get some of these guys back into playing shape. And it certainly did take a while for some, but Johnny seemed ready to go. Unfortunately, he also suffered a few injuries that year that were mainly due to hustling and ridiculous accidents, like an exhibition game against the Yankees that the Giants used to play every year in the middle of the baseball season. They would play a couple of games scattered throughout the year, really, for the Mayor's Cup. And it was just sort of a time when, you know, they'd fill up the Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium with Giants and Yankees fans who otherwise might not get to see these two teams. And Mize was playing and got hit by a pitch in the finger by Joe Page, the Yankee spitballer, great pitcher, but hit Mize and it really took him out for weeks. And when he came back, I think he came back for one game and hurt himself like diving for a ball or diving back to the bag. And so he missed about half of 1946 with injuries, but his numbers were still great. Like when you looked at his 300 and, you know, well over 300 batting average, he hit for power. So in spite of the injuries, he had a terrific season, just not enough to really qualify for any of those, you know, those awards.
Right.
But then 1947, the second year after the war, the year of Jackie Robinson, also the year of the greatest home run race anybody had ever seen to that point, except for the Ruth and Gehrig 1927 race, of course. Johnny Mize and Ralph Kiner chased Babe Ruth's record in 1947. They were both well ahead of the Babe for much of the year. I want to say it's the first year that baseball was really back. I mean, 46 was big, 47 was bigger. The turnstiles were clicking. I mean, they broke records for attendance. Jackie Robinson, of course, was the highlight. People wanted to see Jackie play. You know, he kind of lifted the game in the country. And meanwhile, Mize and Kiner were lifting balls out of the park in, you know, just by the gross. They slowed down the last month. You know, neither of them could keep up with the Babe's pace. And both of them finished with 51 home runs, 9 short of Babe. But nobody had ever seen anything like it. Johnny Mize, for example, was not striking out. He hit 51 home runs and he only struck out 42 times. It was insane.
Incredible.
People couldn't believe this. And it's nothing like that has happened since, and nor will it ever. I mean, you know, now, as you know, most guys will strike out 42 times in a week or a month, you know, so it's a little bit different game now, but he knew how to put the bat on the ball.
Yeah. You know, you talk a little bit about his personality. I think you used the word taciturn and he sounded like a quiet guy. How is he, you know, in the clubhouse? How is he regarded as a teammate by his teammates?
Oh, good question. The teammates I spoke with, who are gone now, unfortunately, they genuinely liked him. They said he was a good teammate. He was, he played hard. They all admitted, you know, and these were mostly guys who knew him. I talked to one fellow who knew Mize as a rookie, Don Gutteridge, and he remembered Mize as being, you know, an all-around player because he saw Mize as a young man. He was not the best fielder in the world, but he was not a bad fielder. This was from Don Gutteridge, Don, who was an infielder, and said Johnny could, when Johnny got to a ball, he got it. And he was a good fielder. He was just not the fastest man in the world. As he got older, his fielding got a little bit more criticism from the men in the clubhouse, and they would tease him about it. And he had a pretty good sense of humor for the most part. But he also, as he got older, became kind of the butt of jokes. This was a funny story that's also in the book. When he was with the Giants, he was kind of shy about his drinking, right? And he wasn't a heavy drinker, but he didn't like to let people know, I like a glass of scotch once in a while. And he was out drinking with his roommate, Bill Rigney. And they had had a few glasses of scotch. And Johnny told Bill, hey, don't tell anybody, you know, about this, you know, because I think they thought of him as a beer drinker. Anyway, the next day, Johnny had been working out and he was sweating like a pig profusely. And Bill said, Johnny, I think that's that liquor that you had last night that's coming out of you. And Johnny told him to hush up. Don't tell anybody. I don't want them to know I was out late last night with you and this kind of thing. And Johnny goes to take his shower. And while he's in the shower, Bill and the clubhouse man, they spray a little bit of lighter fluid where his workout gear was. And when Johnny comes out, they throw a match on it and it bursts into flames. Johnny, look at how much liquor did you drink last night? And, you know, that's sort of Johnny turned red and I think a little embarrassed. So he was kind of an easy guy to mess with. He was mostly good natured. You know, he was a big guy. People didn't want to get him angry at them. And he generally didn't get angry. He was generally sort of the quiet, good old boy type of guy, but who was sort of a professor when it came to hitting. And so if people had teammates had questions about hitting or they wanted advice, they went to him and he was glad to help. You know, all things forgiven, you know, he usually didn't hold a grudge, that kind of thing. So I think he was just sort of a good-natured, quiet type, a go-along to get-along type, but could be also a clubhouse lawyer, you know, could be the one who says, you know, I think Ricky's holding out on us, you know. So you know, he was that guy, you know, he was one of the boys, as they used to say.
Right. And of course, at the end of his career, he winds up with the Yankees, and you know, he was somewhat unlucky, I would say, earlier in his career, and that the Cardinals and the Dodgers really didn't win until after he left. But then he ends up in this perfect situation, well, winning situation certainly in New York, and the greatest team of all time, and they won 5 World Series in a row, and that what a wonderful way to cap off your career. But I wonder, how did he, you know, he was no longer a full-time player with the Yankees, and this is one of the great hitters, players of his generation, and all of a sudden he's relegated to a pinch hitting and kind of spot starting role. How did he adapt to that role with the Yankees? How did he feel about being a part-time player?
You know, I think he absolutely loved it. I think he loved it at that point in his career. I think he felt lucky. You know, and at first, I think he was a little stung that the Giants sold him because he had had some of his best years with the Giants. But he saw the writing on the wall when Leo Durocher came to the Giants in 1949. He made it pretty clear, or 48. Leo came in the middle of 48, actually. But his first full season with the Giants was 49. And Leo made it pretty clear that, you know, he wanted a different kind of ball club. He wanted a club built around speed, defense, you know, the kind of team that he had later when he won pennants with the Giants, you know, built around Willie Mays and Bobby Thompson and good pitching. And so Mize was sort of part of the old guard. He and Willard Marshall and a couple of the other older Giants who were bigger guys who hit for power, and sometimes for average, but just didn't fill, you know, Leo's ideas of what the future would look like. Mize knew that. But I think he still felt a little stung. I think he felt he was going to retire with the Giants, maybe become a coach or something with them. But it didn't take him long to adapt at all. One of the things he said after getting sold to the Yankees on waivers was that, you know, nobody's ever complained about going to the Yankees. He admitted, first, I was stung by this. I didn't expect this at first, but the writing, if I had paid it, you know, all of these things he allowed for. And then he said, you know what though? I'm with the Yankees. And he knew he was in a great situation and he rose to the occasion. And as you alluded to, I think, one of the things that hurt Mize, I believe, in terms of his legacy, is the fact that he left the Cardinals and they went on to win like 3 pennants in 4 years. So how much did that really hurt the Cardinals, right? I mean, you could argue that it didn't hurt them at all. But there are still Cardinal fans to this day. I swear I saw one on Facebook today who's still Cardinal fans who say that they never should have got rid of Mize, you know, because they believe they would have won 6 pennants in a row, you know, that kind of thing. Stan Musial went to his grave believing that that was one of the dumbest deals Sam Braden ever made, was getting rid of Mize. So, you know, you can look at it a few ways. I'm not going to weep over it. The Cardinals won plenty of pennants without him. And then he goes to the Giants, and they're basically a mediocre team. I mean, they're a middle-of-the-road team. And he's one of the stars on a middle-of-the-road team. So, again, not a winner. Lands with the Yankees. What a hell of a way to finish your career. 5 years as a part-time player. A lot of players, I think, with a bigger ego, might have been a little disgusted by that situation. But Mize realized what his limitations were at that point in his career. He had injured himself a few times. His shoulder was always hurting. He had dove several times for balls and landed on his throwing shoulder. So throwing was agony for him. So in those last 5 years, I think he enjoyed being Casey Stengel's sort of bench hitting coach.
And when he retired, you said the narrative is kind of that this guy's a surefire Hall of Famer. It sounded like it. And then, of course, you talked a little before about how he didn't get in, and he didn't get in for a long time. And so what happened there exactly?
I think Mize's personality probably worked against him. He could come across as surly sometimes, when really he was just sort of quiet, you know, and I think that was one thing, right? Sports writers kind of have to like you. It helps. The other thing is the rules of the Hall of Fame induction sort of changed. And the other thing was those last 5 years. You know, those last 5 years, a lot of the voters remember he was a part-time player with the Yankees. He wasn't a Hall of Fame player, though he had some incredible games. And the Yankees likely wouldn't have been as great as they were without his bat. You know, the 3 home runs he hit in the 52 World Series, the game-winning hits in 49. I mean, he played a lot of important roles in those 5 years. But again, they were as a pinch hitter and a part-time player. A lot of sports writers remembered that. They didn't remember those first 10 years, especially, you know, with the Cardinals and Giants when he was leading the league in so many categories. So that worked against him. But the induction rules changed. When Mize retired in 1953, at that time, players could be inducted a year after they had retired. The year after Mize retired, they extended it to the 5-year rule that we have now. A player waits 5 years before they're eligible. And so Mize had to wait 5 years. Then by the time that 5 years had elapsed, they had changed the induction rules to every other year. So instead of having a Hall of Fame election and induction every year, they did it every other year. So the chances for getting in were a little more difficult. I think over time, they just sort of forgot. It is a mystery because you see how some players got in whose records were either comparable or maybe not as good. And then Mize, like, as you said, waited all this time. He finally, after 20 years, the rules were that you passed out of the writer's ballot. You were no longer eligible on the writer's ballot. And after a couple of years, you went to the Veterans Committee. Well, Mize got in on his second or third year of eligibility with the Veterans Committee. And was happy for that. He felt that was an honor because these were his peers. And even though I think he was still stung, it wasn't the kind of thing that he actively picketed for, right? When he was asked, especially as he got older, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, and he was nearing the end of his eligibility with the writers, and he was asked by writers, by sports writers, he would tell them, he says, I don't know what the problem is. I was told I was a shoe-in, and when I look at my numbers, they're pretty good, and they hold up to other guys who were in there. And so he, you know, that was important to him. It told me that he thought that his legacy was very important to him. And the more I read about, especially those stories of, that he was quoted in as an old man, the more I realized that that was really important to him. Some guys don't give a damn, you know. And Mize certainly was playing for the money. He was not the sentimental sort of person, but he did take what he did seriously. He did feel like, you know, I was damn good. I should be recognized for that. But he wasn't the kind of guy to, say shed a tear over the good old days, right? That was not his way. He was sort of a modern man in many ways, a modern athlete in many ways, but also again took what he did seriously and felt that he deserved that. That call from the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and you know, you can't discount the 3 years that he spent in the service, how that might have affected it, because, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, you hear, of course, you know, I mean, Willie Mays might have broken Roos record, and I mean, maybe even Ted Williams had an outside shot at Roos record if he didn't lose it. And you look at Mize, and what do you have, 350 home runs, something like that?
Sure, he probably, I mean, you know, you could extrapolate, and he easily would have had, you know, 400 to 500 home runs.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you could probably, in those three years in the middle of his prime, that might be 100 home runs more.
I think in the years he was putting together in the Polo Grounds, it's easy to imagine him having 100 to 150 more homers, you know, and also, you know, all the other numbers, all the other cumulative statistics, right? But that, the interesting thing, and, you know, you've seen this. Some players have bemoaned that fact. I never came across, in my research, I didn't come across Mize or many of his contemporaries complaining that, man, if I hadn't lost those 3 years, I'd have had, you know, 500, 600. That's an interesting thing that I noted about, maybe it's that generation of player. I don't know, but I mean, all of them. I mean, and I'm talking about athletes who were white, athletes who were black. I mean, certainly there's a lot of bemoaning the fact that it was a whites only game for so long, for no reason. And that, you know, and that for every reason, we should, you know, feel disgusted over that. And we should be able to question, geez, how many wins would Satchel Paige have had in the big leagues and Josh Gibson? But, you know, Mize, again, he was not one to ever go back over that and bemoan it. And nor do I think, this is something I wanted to make clear too. I didn't want Mize to come across as a crusader, but I also didn't want him to come across. He wasn't a guy who was going to stand in the way of integration. This came up. Somebody asked me this question about Mize and integration and him being a Southern man and being there when Jackie Robinson broke in as a Giant, for God's sakes, the arch rival. I couldn't find anything where Mize said anything positive or negative about Jackie Robinson. The only thing I could find was from Monty Irvin, who broke the racial barrier with the New York Giants, with Hank Thompson, the first black player with the New York Giants, that Mize was one of the guys who helped him. You know, Mize was one of the Giants. So again, I think Mize was one of those guys who didn't necessarily reach out, but he was always open for the opportunity, glad to share what he knew, actually proud to share what he knew, because he wrote a damn book about it, for God's sakes. He wrote a book called How to Hit because he figured he knew so much about hitting. One of the jokes is that he was on the Yankees bench telling some of his players, what are you hitting at that crappy pitch for? And somebody said, why the hell don't you write a book about it if you know so much? And he did.
That's very funny. Yeah, you know, and you kind of allude to in the book that it's, you know, as frustrating as it must have been for him to not get in the Hall of Fame, there's almost a certain greater honor in being elected in by the Veterans Committee, which is made up of your peers. And that's, you know, more so than the writers who, you know, some of whom had agendas or grudges or whatever you want to call it. And but they didn't play the game. You know, the guys that it's evident from your book that the guys who played the game, that Johnny's peers, whether it be Ralph Kiner or Hank Greenberg or Mutual, Mantle, they all had the utmost respect for him.
They all knew what he could do. They all listened to him when he had advice. It's like so much of anything else, right? I mean, you've heard this phrase, the musician's musician, you know, the guy who works in the studio that every rock star wants to have on his or her album, right? And that was kind of like Mize, you know, the acquired taste. He was, people who knew were like, oh yeah, that's the guy who he uses a bat like it's a scalpel. You know, he's the lesser known Ted Williams, that kind of thing. You know, he's certainly not saying he was in Williams' class as a hitter, but he was the next best thing. And even Ted Williams, elected Mize to his Hitters Hall of Fame, you know, and Ted could be notoriously a difficult judge of talent, right? But he knew hitting. And again, Mize was probably born about, 80 years too early, because in today's game, Mize would have been a designated hitter supreme. I mean, that would have been the thing. They would have brought him up. He would have played first base as a backup, and they would have said, just hone that batting eye. You're going to play 20 years and you're going to hit 600 home runs and you're going to be David Ortiz, this kind of thing. That's who he would have been. But again, he knew enough about how to play the defense, especially when he was a younger man, that he could handle the position. And I do think that one of the things sports writers held against him was, he wasn't much of a fielder. And look, when he left the Cardinals won all those World Series. So how good was he? And so there was that. But as you said, you had his peers who were like, no, you don't understand. You don't know what it felt like to play second base when Mize was coming up to bat and you wanted to back up three or four steps. And so these were the people who knew. And consequently, when he was finally inducted, he made mention of the fact that some people had teased him, hey, Johnny, don't you think that's kind of getting in the back door when the Veterans Committee votes you in the Hall of Fame? And he said, what do you mean back door? Look at who's on the Veterans Committee. Those are players and managers, a lot of them in the Hall of Fame themselves. Those are your peers. When you are an actor and your peers elect you, you get an Oscar, you get an Academy Award. And, you know, he says, so I feel like I've gotten my Academy Award. So he was very proud of that. I think it was one of those things that, in retrospect, I think he was glad that it's like, wow, okay, this was worth waiting for because of who voted for me. I think that meant more to him personally. I don't think he was the kind of guy who kept tabs on who and who wasn't voting for him, you know, in the sports writing world. But I think he just knew he wasn't in. And then when he got in, it felt great.
Yeah, and once you're in, you're in. Doesn't matter how many years it took, or you know, right, or who whether it was the writers or the Veterans Committee. In your opinion, where does he? I don't love to do rankings, but where does he rank? Where is he kind of, or what tier is he in when you talk about all time first baseman or all time players?
Sure, I think that's a great question. I think I definitely would not put him in the category of say Gehrig. Thinking of the more modern, you think of a Pujols. And yet, if he had played in today's game, he might have been like a Pujols, right? So I think I would rank him in that second tier of great all-time first baseman. I would rank him with Hank Greenberg. You know, I think I had to have them as sort of equals. I definitely, in the book, there's one small section that sort of compares the two of them. That came up because of an email conversation I had with Bill James, the great, baseball author and historian, statistician and whatnot. We exchanged a few emails, and I wanted to ask him his thoughts about Mize. And, I'd read some of his books, and he ranked Mize ahead of Greenberg. And I got to trust that. I mean, this is Bill James. Yeah, he helped build world. He helped bring a World Series back to Boston, for God's sake. So I think I'm going to trust that. So I put Mize as, maybe top. He's definitely in my book, top 6, 7, 8 first baseman all time. But I wouldn't say, top 2 or 3, Jimmy Fox, Greenberg, Buck Leonard in the Negro Leagues. I mean, these guys were first baseman extraordinaire. Even Oscar Charleston, who in the Negro Leagues was known as a center fielder, but played a great first base as well. Another guy that Johnny Mize played against Oscar Charleston, Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell. you know, Martin Diego. So yeah, the names just drop out of a hat.
Yeah, amazing. All right, Jerry, I'll get you out of here with one last question I like to ask all my guests. But once again, the name of Jerry's book is Big Cat, The Life of Baseball Hall of Famer Johnny Mize. And we didn't really get into why his nickname was Bill Cat, but it's described in the book. You'll have to read the book to find out. Jerry, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
Whoa, great question. An easy one for me. It's Ball Four by Jim Boughton. That's one that I reread not every year, but many years around this time. If I don't, nowadays I listen to it because there's an audio version with Boughton reading it.
Oh, really?
And it's awesome. Yes, it's Boughton's voice. And the beauty of it is that he'll chuckle at places where, it's very personable. And it's hard for me to listen to that book without coming to tears at the end, because it also has updates, on what sort of happened. And he had some tragedies in his own life. Of course, Jim Boughton is gone now, but that's number one for me. And there's a whole bunch of them in the top 10. There's at least 100 in the top 10.
Sure. All right. Well, Jerry, thanks so much for coming on to talk about the book. I, as you can tell, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was great to learn about Johnny Mize and so many other figures, through his experiences. So thanks again for coming on to talk about it.
I really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
All right.